You are listening to Walking Home from the ICU. We will be exploring how to save and preserve lives in the ICU. All opinions and views shared are unaffiliated with any organization.
If your team is ready to improve patient outcomes, check out the website www.daytonicuconsulting.com for information about webinars and consulting services.
Okay, the next three episodes are dedicated to exploring the ABCDEF bundle in the CVICU. My own uncle likely spent an additional 2 days on mechanical ventilation in a CVICU because awakening trials were not a priority for the team. We now have vast research proving the safety, feasibility, and benefit of the A2F bundle in cardiac ICU patients of varying diagnoses and devices. Please check out the transcriptions and citations for this episode on my website under the Resources tab. This episode, I am ecstatic to share with you the insights of Anna Dalton, nurse practitioner in an awake and walking CVICU. Anna, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Can you introduce yourself to us?
Yes, my name is Anna Dalton. I am a critical care nurse practitioner. I work in a cardiovascular intensive care unit. I've been doing that for the full 4 years of being an NP. And prior to that, I worked for 4 years as a nurse. And then prior to that, a few more years as a nurse. But I've been there a total of 8 years now. And I love doing it. I love cardiac critical care.
So the CVICU is your jam. That is your expertise. And that's exactly why I have you on today. You have spent most of your time in that ICU, and it's an ICU that's renowned for their mobility program.
Correct.
You guys have put out research, done really advanced cutting edge things throughout the years. So I recognize that that's just normal for you. But as we appreciate throughout this podcast is that the culture and practices vary throughout all the different specialties and all the different ICUs within those specialties. So today I really want to dive in with you about your team and your perspective on the ABCDEF bundle in CVICU. I think this applies also to CTICU, all the cardiovascular intensive care patients that are out there. Why is the ADEF bundle so important in your specialty?
I think it's so important because in the overall perspective of somebody being in the ICU, it decreases your ICU length of stay, as well as it decreases your hospital length of stay, which then improves your overall mortality. I believe that in the last 10 years of my nursing career, I've seen a huge shift and change from heavily sedated patients to less sedated patients, more awake, more alert, who can participate, who can write down what their wishes are, or have conversations with family. And it just, it helps to really improve their ICU stay and get them out of the hospital, which is what they ultimately want.
And you're coming from a large teaching hospital, which some of us from other hospitals, especially rural hospitals, will say, well, we don't have those kind of resources. But I think another consideration too, is that you're caring for really high acuity patients who are on a lot of support and a lot of devices. So what are the kind of diagnoses, acuities, and devices that you care for in that ICU?
So our patients actually come from inside of Utah, as well as from the surrounding states. If there are smaller hospitals in Idaho, Wyoming, Montana, Nevada, sometimes even New Mexico, they can't handle their patients because they're too sick, they have devices, and they ship them to us. So we're dealing with a lot of, I work with all of the cardiothoracic post-surgical patients, and they can have a wide variety of cardiac related illnesses, as well as I work with lung transplants, vascular patients, and some thoracic patients. And we manage all the different types of devices. We've got breathing tubes, we've got a continuous dialysis, and then we've got balloon pumps, the two different types of Impellas. We've got VA and VV ECMO, and I think I already said balloon pumps.
So there's a lot going on. There's a diverse population. And within cardiac patients in general, what are some of the unique risk factors for delirium or ICU-acquired weakness?
So there's lots of different factors with surgical patients. Some of the ones that I thought of that are non-modifiable that we really don't have control over: somebody's cardiopulmonary bypass time, their cross clamp time in the OR, any circ arrest time that they have in the OR, their pathophysiology. If they have a calcified aorta, you do an aortic surgery, you're going to have a higher risk of having pieces of calcium flick off and having little mini strokes during surgery. Their age, a history of dementia, if they come out with an open chest and they have plans to go back to the OR. So there's a lot of non-modifiable things that can occur. Some modifiable things that I feel like occur in the ICU that help to prevent delirium: sleep, pump alarms, making sure patients are aware of day-night. Once you get them off of that cycle, of the normal cycle, they get very confused. Making sure family's available, making sure their pain's under control, making sure you're working on trying to get their breathing tube out and having PT and OT available for, you know, trying to normalize what they would do at home, but in the ICU, as well as trying to manage their pain with opiates, decreasing the amount, making sure that they are awake enough to participate in their care if they're hemodynamically stable.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I hear concerns. What about post-op pain? Our patients are coming out of surgery. When do you take sedation off? Lots of different questions. And because you have these unique risk factors within your population, it sounds like your team, instead of saying, well, they're going to have delirium, they're going to be agitated, we just need to keep sedation going, it sounds like you take those risk factors into consideration to say, therefore, we must be more proactive. We must prevent delirium or implement these interventions because they're so at risk. And that's a different culture.
Yes. I don't think people really understand the risks of delirium. You know, you said, oh, well, it's just delirium. They can handle it. Delirium is a huge spectrum of what can happen to somebody's brain. And it can last years or more, that decrease in brain function that occurs when you have delirium. And there have been patients who have given testimonials of like, you know, I was a really good accountant before I had ICU delirium, and now I can't really do basic math because of how much delirium I had, and I can't go back to that job anymore. And it's important to look at it as, oh, it's not just ICU delirium. We can't really prevent it because there have been studies and there are ways that we as providers, we as nurses can work with our patients to help reduce or prevent number of days of delirium.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, with those non-modifiable risk factors, there are going to be high rates of delirium. I was just doing a medical review for a man that had a CABG, bivessel graft, and he had some postoperative delirium 3 and 4 days after surgery, but seemed to kind of get better, was sent home. And he got so confused. He was getting his gun out, shooting around, thinking that people were on his property and had to be re-hospitalized. And they couldn't figure out why he was delirious. And he spent almost 2 weeks in the hospital before the PT or OT came. He was just had florid delirium. And so he spent another month in the hospital, primarily for delirium. And yet looking at his chart, he had constant disruptions at night. He was stable, but he was getting vital signs throughout the night, labs drawn at 2-4 in the morning, just because that's when they would do it. And I don't know that the ICU would ever imagine that he would come back to the hospital just for delirium and spend a month there, lose 30 pounds because he wasn't being mobilized, because he was, again, it wasn't a priority. It wasn't in their culture, even on the medical floor. And it got me looking, and I saw that 50% of patients post-CABG can develop post-operative delirium. And then when we add in all the other factors that you've described, things that we do to cause that, we must increase those risks. So what is it like in your ICU? You're talking about your perspective, understanding what this is going to look like for a patient down the road. Is that something that your team discusses, and how does that impact how you manage sedation?
Yeah. So what I want you to know is this has not always been the standard of care in our CVICU. When I first started in 2014, it was taught to me by other nurses that when you get a post-op patient in, they come out on propofol and you immediately start them on a fentanyl drip. From there, you wake your patient up, get a neuro exam, make sure they're following commands, and then you put them down and you let them sleep until tomorrow morning. That was just like ingrained in my brain. And once I started NP school and I started learning more about delirium and being like, wait a second, like my patients actually do worse. They're more agitated. They're more anxious. When you sedate them really hard and then they wake up from that, they're going to be more confused. And so we've been working the last 4 or 5 years on taking off sedation as quickly and as safely as possible. So now we are currently working on a study where we're trying to decrease our intubation hours. So I think our average was like 20 something hours with a breathing tube postoperatively, ruling out other people that like an open chest that have to be intubated, et cetera. And what we've been looking at is we want to get the patient to the ICU and maybe they have on some propofol. We do not start a fentanyl drip. We only do IV push fent when they wake up and they can tell us that they're in pain. And then from there, we work on not bolusing as much unless the patient is severely agitated and at risk for harming themselves or their vital signs are very unstable. Then there's going to be some areas of play. And we're trying to get our patients extubated within 6 hours post-op. And so when I go in as the APC, I say, okay, this is the time, it's noon. We're going to have all sedation off by 1 o'clock. And then within 6 hours, we're going to be extubating. And I feel like giving hard stops and verbalizing no more sedation after this time. This is what we're shooting for. And then following up with that has really helped to encourage and to prevent people from getting over sedated when it's not necessary the majority of the time. And we've, in the last year that we've been working on this, we've actually seen a decrease in the average hours that our patients spend intubated. I think it went from 20 to 12 or something like that, which is a huge improvement in our patient population.
How does that impact workload and bed flow and all those things within the ICU during this crisis, especially?
Right. When you get your patient extubated quickly, then you can pair that patient the next shift. Not that all of our intubated patients are single, but you can pair them. So then you only have to have one nurse for two patients, and then they're easier to get them up. It's, you know, you start getting them swallowing, you get them working with physical therapy a little bit faster because they don't have any ventilator settings that you're like, okay, is it okay to get them up? As well as if they're not sedated, they're awake. And I think that's the biggest thing is they can start getting reoriented to their surroundings, that they're out of surgery, that it's X time in the day or it's nighttime. And the patients do better and they actually like it. Nobody likes the breathing tube in.
Absolutely. And so a lot of those patients are those that are appropriate to extubate shortly after. It's mostly post-op. Mm-hmm. What about patients that are going to require mechanical ventilation or devices for longer times? How then do you manage sedation and how do you know when sedation is necessary and then triage levels of sedation? When is it time to take it off? All those things that are very case dependent.
Yeah. So we really, for most of our patients, we try and get them up with physical therapy or work with occupational therapy post-op day one, because we recognize the importance of getting people mobilized. I believe there was a study that said that for every day spent in bed, it's actually 2 to 3 days of physical therapy to gain that strength back, which is insanely important and so crazy that we lose that much muscle mass. And so we look at their hemodynamics, and we've got a lot of numbers that I know a lot of rural hospitals do not. We have Swan-Ganz catheter, so we've got cardiac index, we've got arterial lines, so we have continuous blood pressure monitoring. But we have to look at, okay, what is their blood pressure and how many pressors are they on? If they're on, you know, 2 inotropes and 2 pressors, you've got to look at that and be like, okay, they're a little bit too unstable to start mobilizing today. But if they're down to 1 inotrope and maybe they have vasopressin for a little bit of blood pressure, we can have physical therapy, work with them in bed share, getting them sitting up, trying to get those fluids mobilized and moving because they're going to be orthostatic, and trying to switch them from propofol to dexmedetomidine. There's actually not a lot of research about dexmedetomidine in the ICU setting. People were using it originally to say that it actually gets you off sedation faster. And I believe that the study said that it didn't. However, some people really respond to it. So if you get them off of propofol and onto dex, you can't bolus that med. And so it's less likely that if somebody's agitated, that a nervous nurse would just hurry and bolus to get the patient down. They would come and they'd say, hey, my patient's really agitated. What can we do for them? And so moving towards that, and also moving towards oral medications to help control pain, to help control agitation. So we use opiates and Tylenol. We will, most of the time we use Lyrica to help with chest tube pain because they go through rib spaces. And if they're too sedated on opiates, we go to Tramadol. If they're still too sedated, we take everything off until they're fully awake and screaming out in pain. And then we say, okay, now we'll treat you. And so we have so many medications that are so much better than fentanyl and propofol. And I know some people use Versed. We haven't used that for years.
Yes.
And I just think that people narrow their views and say, well, this is how I've done things, how we've done things. And there's no other way, but there are so many other ways that you can safely have somebody intubated, have somebody with multiple devices. Sometimes we have ECMO and we have a balloon pump and we have a patient that's intubated and they can be resting comfortably on Precedex or dexmedetomidine with PO pain meds. And they can wake up, squeeze hands on a drop of a hat instead of having to do a sedation holiday or vacation.
And I just am imagining the stress and the risk of having patients be delirious with those kind of devices.
Yes.
And so how does that impact safety and everyone's comfort level when you have a patient that's more responsive and reliable and not delirious?
So it definitely comes with time. Those that are delirious and are intubated usually have restraints. And then from there, once they become really alert and we can tell that they're oriented, if the nurse feels safe while they are in the room, they can take the restraints off or they can use mittens or we would get one-to-one close supervision or a sitter to be with them to help kind of, hey, like you're in the ICU, let's try and remember, don't pull at that. But typically we use soft restraints.
That's really interesting to hear because some ICUs are so afraid of restraints and their goal is to avoid restraints. Therefore they chemically restrain them and they shoot for deeper RASs so that they don't have to restrain them. So how do you guys navigate that? I agree with your approach, but why is that the approach?
I don't know as like an institution why that's an approach, but for me, having physical restraints, the soft restraints, doesn't do too much to the patient, right? If you're checking them every 2 hours, I believe is what you have to do. Whereas if you have somebody totally sedated, you're probably only doing sedation vacation once every 4 hours. And so you're actually having more assessments and it's less risk to just have their arms tied down. Not to say that we've never had somebody pull out a line or pull out their ECMO before, because it has happened, but there's just better ways to manage that than just to say, okay, I'm just going to sedate and forget because it's easier for me. And that's what I think we get caught up in is it feels easier for me because I don't have to be super vigilant because I don't have to be at the bedside 100% of the day as they're waking up. I can walk away and feel comfortable about it. And I do agree with that. I did that all the time when I was a nurse, but we've got to start trying to change the mindset of our nurses and our physicians and our PAs and NPs, because we are the ones that are going to be able to create this change among our institution and among the nation. We've got to change because this is unacceptable.
Yeah. And it sounds like you guys have kind of transformed your definition of safety, mm-hmm. that For example, when someone pulled out their ECMO line, I think one of the options would be to shut down the whole program altogether, to just say that happened because they weren't sedated, therefore we must sedate all patients on ECMO. Why wasn't that the response for your team?
I think because we look at all of the factors surrounding why it occurred, not that they're agitated, because I think the patient I'm thinking about was just angry that they were still in the hospital. I don't even think they were delirious. I think that they just got angry and they were done and they went forward and pulled it out. And before, you know, he was trusting, he didn't pull at things. And so I just don't think the right answer is to completely sedate somebody and take away their ability to have any response or reaction to anything. I think in that case, we came together, we had an M&M meeting, and we discussed, okay, you know, next time we're going to double suture in our line, in our ECMO, because it was peripheral ECMO. We got Hollister patches, which are sticky patches that go underneath the ECMO circuit, and they hold them into place. So then each line has to have two of those Hollister patches. And then I think those were like the main takeaways. I can't really remember, but that's, you change your environment to help improve the patient care to make sure that doesn't happen again.
Oh, I love that approach, that it wasn't, you didn't just put the blame on the nurse or on the lack of sedation. It was considering the whole environment and all the factors to then improve the process and make it safer in the future. But you weren't willing to put future patients at risk by going back to deep sedation. It sounds like your team really understands the risks involved with sedation and immobility, and that that helps guide and navigate your decision-making when it comes to sedation. Mm-hmm. What are the usual rascals on your unit?
I have not looked at the nursing rascals in a long time. And I think we use Riker at my hospital. And our goals are, I think I pulled it up. What's the middle? It's like 3-4 of Riker.
I actually don't know Riker that well. I'm used to RAS, where zero's just awake, calm, oriented. It sounds like you guys shoot for a 0 or -1, where they might be a little drowsy.
So that's probably, yeah, with the RAS. With the Riker, we shoot for 4, which is calm and cooperative. Calm, easily arousable, follows commands.
Sounds like a RAS of 0. That's great.
Yeah. We want them to be able to participate as much as their hemodynamics can tolerate. And it's so much better for patients. It's so much better for the nurse, just overall, to have their patient be able to tell them what they would like, whether it's writing or pointing or nodding, makes for a better nursing patient care.
And what kind of cases or situations would deeper sedation be necessary?
So patients that would need deeper sedation, anybody, well, even people with an open chest, maybe when they first come out with an open chest. But even so, I've had people with open chest, not on any sedation, fully awake. And I had a patient just last week, open chest, was in a ton of pain. And I had the nurse tell me that they bolused propofol. And I had to educate that propofol is not a pain medication. It is a sedative. It does not help at all with pain. So let's figure out what's going on. I would like you to be off of propofol by the end of the day. And let's start pain meds. Started with oral pain meds. Those weren't cutting it. I moved to Presidex. That wasn't cutting it. I added a ketamine drip. And then after I added the ketamine drip, the patient was alert. The patient was calm. He was saying, no, I'm not in any pain, and nodding and awake. And he eventually went and got his chest closed and came back to the unit. And then we started over again. And we already knew he responds really well to ketamine. Let's put him back on ketamine. And so trying those different things that you can still get to that point. Other parts or other things that may prohibit is just really bad hemodynamic instability. Somebody that is very septic, but also has heart failure and is on devices. So giving fluid isn't the goal. And that's even hard to justify, because really our goal is to get the sedation off and get them extubated as soon as we can. We did have a lot of COVID ECMO patients, so patients with ARDS that come in and get VV ECMO. We do have to heavily sedate those patients in order to obtain good oxygenation and ventilation. So when they come to us on high ventilator settings and then we put them on VV ECMO, that doesn't just solve all of our problems. We have to slowly work down on our vent settings, and patients are extremely tachypneic. They're extremely agitated because they feel like they cannot breathe, even though their oxygen and their oxygen levels are great and their CO2 levels are great now that they have ECMO. And so working towards getting them on an okay sedation regimen is actually really difficult. So we have ended up on Versed drips and Dilaudid drips, and then eventually those have to be weaned off, and those can take a long time. But for our cardiothoracic patients, it's usually pretty quick that we're working on other methods to keep them calm and pain-free, or less pain.
I remember Tyler, I interviewed him on the podcast. He came from the Wake and Walk in ICU, had severe ARDS, could not oxygenate with movement, that hit our threshold for deep sedation. He was prone. We had him cannulated there and sent to your unit. And not too long after he got there, he was back on his feet on ECMO. Right. Like ECMO facilitated mobility. How often do you see that? I know you guys mobilize quite a few patients on ECMO, but apparently it's a process. And I'm sure it's difficult when they come from facilities that have deeply sedated them for prolonged periods of time. That must be its own barrier in working through the delirium and ICU acquired weakness while on high support.
Correct. If they come to us and they've been previously sedated for a long period of time, then you're working against all of that sedation and trying to essentially keep them from withdrawing from all of that, because your body becomes addicted to whatever medication, whatever opiates or sedation you give them, you become addicted. And that's just a fact with our patient load. But with that case specifically, there are a lot of patients that we put on VV ECMO and we give them a couple of days to get their ventilator settings down so that we can walk them. And then we're getting them up as soon as it's safe. Sitting in bed chair, standing, doing step. Sometimes our physical therapy is just sitting in bed chair and doing 5 stands with physical therapy and standing there. Our physical therapists also have tilt beds. So we get a whole team together and we move a patient over to tilt bed if they get super orthostatic, and then they can slowly move them up standing into like a 45 degree angle. But it improves their morale, first of all, because they recognize that, okay, I can do this. I can work really hard and I can get these devices out of me and get home. When you're laying in bed and you're not doing anything, I think that decreases your amount of determination and motivation to get out of there. You feel stuck. You feel like you are never going to leave the hospital when you just lay there in bed.
How long has the ECMO program been running there? And at what point did your team start mobilizing them? And how did that impact the whole unit?
I think the ECMO program was actually going before we had a CVICU, when it was just a surgical ICU and we got trauma patients as well as some cardiothoracic patients. But our cardiothoracic surgeons have been building their program really, really well and reaching out to different hospitals in rural areas. And so now we have our own unit. So for at least 8 years, we have been mobilizing, but it's really been within the last 6 years that I feel like it's been a huge movement of like, all right, it is time. We've got to get these people up. We've got to get them moving. It's so important. And we've got an amazing physical therapy, occupational therapy staff who's so active on the unit and so willing to help get people up, get them moving. They're very encouraging to our patients. We have little Bluetooth speakers in every room that is for the patient to use, and their family can hook up their phone to it, and we can play their favorite songs while we're walking, and really anything that helps get them motivated. And I have seen such a dramatic change in not only our patients, but our patient population has actually gotten younger. We've seen so many patients in their 20s and 30s, whereas when I first started, I felt like they were all older, 50s, 60s, 70s. And I think that has just shown that we need to shift. We can't let 20s and 30 year olds lay in bed all day. And maybe in our minds, we thought, oh yeah, they're 70, they can lay in bed all day, that's fine. And now that's not the case. You can't, you should not do that.
It's like, it should be the opposite, right? People say, well, we have really geriatric patients. And in my mind, those are even more important to mobilize, because how can they rehabilitate, or how, what is that going to do for their mortality after the ICU? And it sounds like your team just expects most patients, if not all patients, to be up and moving. And mm-hmm. when a patient is delirious, how does your team respond to that, especially when you have devices? Again, you've mentioned sitters, restraints, sleep schedules, things like that. Culturally, how do you discuss delirium? Now that you're an NP and you're talking with nurses, how does everyone utilize the CAM score and respond to it?
So the CAM score is done by the nurses every shift, and we discuss it during rounds in the morning. And the nurses also tell us if they're CAM positive. From there, we decide, okay, we need to implement anti-delirium protocol. It's not an official protocol. It's something that I worked on as a graduate student. Essentially, what it is there are things to do during the day and there are things to do during the night to help reduce the amount of delirium that somebody might have. We pull it up. So there are day shift actions that we talk to the nurses about, making sure lights are on, blinds are open, and the doors are open, making sure if they're falling asleep that somebody's in the room talking to them, encouraging family to be there, which is really nice now that we're kind of loosening up visitation. That was hard with COVID, making sure, you know, if the family's not there, that they've got music to listen to or the TV's on. Getting them up to some sort of chair position if they can't walk, making sure that they're sitting up somewhat. If they are laying flat because they have, you know, VA ECMO in their groin and an Impella or something like that, then making sure that they're reverse Trendelenburg. Can't remember which one.
Yeah, Trendelenburg. Okay. Reverse Trendelenburg.
There you go. That they're sitting up as much as possible, decreasing caffeine intake after 3, and encouraging activities to prevent napping, especially late in the day. That would make them stay awake. One other thing that we have done is we give the majority of people melatonin. Now, a lot of people say, well, melatonin doesn't work for me. But one of the physicians that I used to work with, he said, well, we're giving it at the wrong time. We're giving it at 9, 10, 11 o'clock, which is the wrong time. Our melatonin inside our own bodies actually starts to be released right at dusk. And so the best time to give it is like 6 or 7 p.m. to get them kind of relaxed and into that. And then if they really need something for sleep, maybe giving some trazodone at 8 or 9 o'clock to help them get to sleep. And that I feel like has improved our patients. The other things that we do at night, earplugs, eye masks, you would not believe how much that helps patients if they're not hearing the pumps beeping, making sure you're doing pump rounds as nurses and making sure their bags available, that it's not beeping, dimming all the lights, having the blinds drawn. And some people may disagree with this, but kicking family out at a decent hour. I feel like when family is in the room overnight, they fret about things that are not to be fretted about, that are maybe like artifact on the telemetry that may read VTAC and it's really not. And minimizing RN interruptions, but they still need to check their pumps or check their Foley output. Those are important. You know, you can go into the room, you can have your little pupil light, and you can look at those things without disturbing the patient and turning on all of the lights, making sure they've got appropriate pain control so they can sleep, optimizing. There's so many things that you can do to create a home environment for the patient in order to get them to sleep?
I think one of the beefs that people have sometimes is, well, if our patients aren't sedated, then when do we do our baths? We can't do our 2 a.m. bath. When do you guys, how do you manage your bath schedule?
You know, that's actually kind of funny because it's like, do you ever take a 2 a.m. bath? You probably don't. And sometimes that does happen. If somebody has a massive bowel movement, they may decide right then and there, hey, we're going to clean you up. We're going to wash you up really quick. But that is typically during the day or right before they go to sleep. And I actually feel like baths right before they go to sleep can actually improve patient sleep because it's like a calm, it's time to calm down. You're going to bed. We're going to get you all nice and clean. And then you can sleep. Interrupting somebody's sleep just to give them a bath, I feel like is a waste of your time as a nighttime nurse. You shouldn't be doing that. There's other things that you can be doing, and it doesn't improve the patient's outcome in any way by doing a bath in the middle of the night.
Do you do mobility in the evening?
Yes, we can do mobility in the evening. Some of our patients, when they're a physical therapy assist, with their assistant, with our nurses, it's kind of impossible to do. They're usually there until about 6 or 7, so they can help get people from the chair where they're eating back to bed. And then there's a few patients that are pretty mobile that can get up with just nurses that will do laps in the evening.
I am such a believer in that. I swear that improves sleep as well. And how does your team navigate all the exceptions when things are not idyllic? How does your team work together to help patients through those severe repercussions?
I feel like one thing is it's a constant discussion of how every day we're talking about how we're going to get that patient mobilized, or when can we get that patient mobilized, or what can we do to start getting them mobilized. I can't think of an exact example right now, but I think having that open dialogue with nurses and saying, hey, this patient has to get up today, whether you sit them in a bed chair, if PT is not available, or they come over and get them into a chair. Okay, they really need to make it out of the room today. And again, a lot of this does come from our physical therapists. They are really good at working with that. And we make sure that every single person has a PT and OT evaluate and treat order. That's extremely important to have. And I wish I could think of an example of how we navigate that. I think it's working slowly from like doing work in the bed to sitting in a bed chair to standing at the bed to just sitting in a regular chair, to getting out the patient door. It's a lot of steps and it is a lot of work, but in order to even qualify for inpatient rehab, which is kind of our gold standard, we want people to go there because we have an amazing facility. You've got to be able to tolerate 3 hours of physical therapy, occupational therapy, or speech therapy during the day. And so we really try and shoot for that. Okay, like we want to get you up. We want to get you moving. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And it sounds like your therapists are so specialized in what they're doing and so educated. I know you guys have a training program for your rehab services. And and it shows in how your team works together. You trust their assessments. You trust their input. You're working closely with them. It sounds like PT, OT, and speech are in the ICU, not just visiting the ICU. They are an integrated part of the team. And that sounds like that's key, especially with all the devices, all the specialized cases that you have. And that sounds like it's key. And how has your role changed from an RN to an NP in implementing these interventions?
Right. So I just feel like my perspective has changed a lot in that I've, you know, done some research about delirium. I can see the repercussions that come when they leave the ICU. Not that I ever see patients after the ICU, but I want to get them. I have this desire to want to get them off the sedation because I know that they're going to be much more compliant, much more or easier to work with as a practitioner. And I just don't think some of our older nurses can see that because they're ingrained in their ways. We do have a lot of newer nurses and they are just learning. And so they're absorbing all of this and they're a lot easier to train and be like, hey, this is the reason why we're moving towards this. And it's the older nurses that are a little bit more nervous to adapt to new protocols.
Yeah, I think there's such an opportunity for APCs to take a leadership in this, to bring all the disciplines together, to work towards this. And so I love that you're using your experiences in an RN where you understand what they're going through. You know what it's like to have a delirious, agitated patient, the workload required in those situations. And then you're using this to teach and educate. And I think that's what we really need, especially during rounds. On the side, we need leadership, APCs, MDs, to help bring the team together and then really talk about the why behind it. So I appreciate that that's what you're doing. And then you're even publishing things to help share this expertise with the rest of the ICU community. Do you mind sharing your recent publication?
Yeah, so the study that I worked on in the surgical ICU and the cardiovascular ICU, I worked on that during graduate school and then we finished it up after. It's called The Effect of a Quality Improvement Intervention on sleep and delirium in critically ill patients in a surgical ICU. And it included 646 surgical ICU admissions in patients. And we looked at patients pre-intervention, which was pre-sleep protocol. And then we looked at patients post. And we included every single patient, whether they were open chest, multiple devices or not. And we also looked at their pain score. And if the pain score, if the patient couldn't tell us, the nurse would guesstimate on what they thought the patient's pain was. And we showed that by implementing a sleep protocol, which is what I described before, simple things of, you know, lights on, lights off, those type of things that any hospital could implement, that there was a reduction in number of delirium days in the ICU. And I think that's really important for people to understand is that this isn't groundbreaking research, really. You know, turning the lights on, turning them off, giving somebody earplugs. It's something that anybody can do and things that maybe we would do at home. We're trying to mimic the home environment in the ICU in order to get people to sleep so they can be awake during the day and participate in their own cares. And I feel like we take away so much of patients' autonomy and ability to care for themselves by bathing them, by brushing their teeth, by managing everything that they're doing from the start of the day to the end of the day, that we don't realize that that could also impact their delirium. So giving them back a little piece of sanity from their home life actually benefits them in the long run.
And you did a lot of this legwork as an RN and now publishing as an NP. It's so neat to see that anyone and everyone can contribute to this work and this process of care, and that there's still so much to be discovered. And like you said, a lot of this isn't groundbreaking. We've known this for a long time. And it can be applied in very personal ways in every specialty. And it's exciting to hear what your CVICU is doing. We'll include your publication and other links to other research specifically for cardiac ICU patients and A to F bundle. Anything else you would share with the ICU community? Especially for those that are really daunted by getting to where your team is at.
I think it can be very daunting to look at this and feel like, okay, we need to get there today. I think you and your team need to sit down and discuss what is something that is easy that we can start implementing. You can start off so small just by saying, okay, somebody's going to walk around every single night and make sure that lights are dimmed, make sure that, you know, doors are not fully closed, but partially closed so that the nursing station noise. I think if you start small and then work up from there, you can start preventing delirium. Maybe you half your propofol drips, or maybe you half your Versed drips and just say, we're not going to go above this threshold. I think that can get into people's minds and feel so overwhelming. Okay, we're just going to take everything off. And really, this took a long time for our unit to get to this point. It took years. And so if you start small and you work your way through it and create some sort of plan with everybody and get buy-in from nurses and physicians and APCs, then you'll be able to start implementing. And yeah, there's going to be some cases where, you know, you're going to sedate somebody and that will be okay. But if you're working on changing your whole practice, it's going to take a lot of time and a lot of effort from everybody on staff.
But I appreciate the perspective and the vision that you've given of what I really would call an awake and walking CVICU, being responsible with our sedation, implementing all the holistic practices that the A to F bundle is all about. Thank you so much, Anna, for sharing your expertise. And we hope to learn more from you and your team. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
To schedule a consultation and connect on social media, as well as find supportive resources, including case studies, ebook, episode transcripts, and citations to research, please visit the website www.daytonicuconsulting.com.